This episode of the podcast Under the Stairs is brought to you in conjunction with Legion Podcast Network. Check out the podcast Under the Stairs and many other shows over at legionpodcast.com. Welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. Hi everyone and welcome to this very special bonus episode of the podcast Under the Stairs. I'm your host Duncan McLeish and welcome to the show. This week and next week on the podcast Under the Stairs, you will be hearing two very special bonus episodes. Now you may wonder why two bonus episodes back to back. Well, the reason behind that is that I am going on holiday, or if you are of an American persuasion, vacation. And I have not been able to basically get movies watched, guests picked, and shows recorded in order to put them out. And I don't really want to leave you guys with 2 weeks of no recordings, because I know how I feel when my favourite podcasts take a holiday, a well-earned vacation, and there is no content for a couple of weeks. It can be quite frustrating. So I arranged two episodes, the first one coming today and one coming next Monday. Now, the plan for these two episodes is basically to give you content in one form or another, slightly different from what you would usually get on the podcast Under the Stairs. So, this episode, I will be joined later on for a special interview with none other than former guest host on this show, Legion Runner, and the podcasting mind behind such great shows as Schadenfreude Gaming and Duncan and Bo Come Correct, Mr. Bo Ransdell, and a gentleman by the name of Ian Kesner. Now, the two of these guys got together and put out a little movie called Lost After Dark, which finally arrived last year. And they have that movie now out in the States. So you can buy it on Blu-ray, DVD. I think you can watch it on various different mediums over there as well, like iTunes. But the movie had not been released in the United Kingdom, where obviously this podcast is situated. So, with that in mind, and knowing that the movie was about to be released in physical and digital format in the United Kingdom on the 29th, the day of this show being released, I thought it'd be a good idea to get those two chaps on and ask them some questions. How they two met, you know, how the production of the movie went, and what it's like to finally have a movie out there, and obviously the fact that they've released a movie, now they're millionaires. So yeah, the two will be coming up very shortly on this show to talk about that. Next week, I will be joined with none other than The Baz, and we're just going to shoot the shit. We're just basically going to fill up some dead air with our nonsense and ramblings. You guys have submitted questions, we will answer them, and we'll just generally catch up with Baz. Has done a lot of horror watching, so it'd be kind of cool to see what he made of certain things. I know he watched Deathgasm, I know he loved it, so that in itself should merit an entire show. So yeah, we're going to do that on next week's episode. So without any further ado, I'm going to take a very short break just now. You're going to hear some promos for shows that I love. When I return, I'm going to be joined by Mr. Bo Ransdell and Ian Kesner, and we're going to be discussing Lost After Dark right after this.
Hello?
Hello. Who is this?
Who are you trying to reach?
I don't know.
I think you've got the wrong number.
Do I?
I'm going to hang up.
Wait, don't hang up. What's that noise?
Popcorn?
You're making popcorn?
Uh-huh.
I only eat popcorn when I listen to podcasts.
I'm about to listen to a podcast.
Oh, really? Which one?
Probably the podcast on Haunted Hill.
Is that the one with the two guys with the beards?
Yeah, Dan and Gav. Most episodes, they look at two different horror movies. Each episode, they look at a world of the strange, where they look at weird things from around the world. Sometimes, they even do special episodes where they look at different genres or directors' discographies and talk about them.
Do you have a boyfriend?
Maybe.
So where can I find the podcast on Haunted Hill?
Well, you can go to legionpodcast.com, Facebook, Twitter, or just go into iTunes and search for the podcast on Haunted Hill. So, are you going to ask me out?
Do you like movie reviews that are insightful, thought-provoking, and delivered by somebody who's trained to critically dissect every aspect of a motion picture without ever having to use obscenities?
then you've got the wrong show. Kruger Nation Horror Podcast is ready to feed your slasher movie and exploitation needs. There'll be more blood, expletives, and titties than you can shake your grandma's beetle flaps at. Visit www.krugernation.com.
Oh, good God, a butthole casserole! And welcome back. So it is my esteemed privilege and pleasure at this time to introduce my two guests that I will be interviewing for the next little segment here. These gentlemen, one of them you will be very familiar with because he has graced this show many times, is a good friend of the show, Mr. Bo Ransdell. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, sir. How about yourself?
I am doing fantastic. I'm very excited about this because we have someone who collaborated and directed some of your work last year, well, it would be the year before as well, to produce a film which is finally making its way into a digital and physical format in the UK. That gentleman's name is Ian Kessner. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing good, sir. It's nice to be here.
It's great to have you here. So yeah, the two of you guys did that thing that every podcaster out there in my neck of the woods wishes they could do but haven't done, and that is actually put a horror movie out in a level where it's not only available to pretty much everyone now, but people can get it on a physical format or VOD, and like I say, it's finally making its way over to the UK on Monday the 29th on DVD format. So the first thing I'd like to ask, and I'll start with you, Ian, because everyone has heard enough of Bo.
granted, so, yeah, that's accurate.
That is true. So could you give us a bit of the history of how you got involved in the film industry, how you got involved in directing movies?
Sure. Okay. So I was interested in movies from a very young age. And at a certain point, I was actually on a trajectory to be a lawyer, which
oh, really?
my folks thought I would be, but then I disappointed them and told them I wanted to be a director. So yeah, I mean, I went to NYU for a summer program to see, you know, I had been studying in college a lot of film theory, and we didn't have an opportunity to get our hands on the equipment. And the equipment back then wasn't as accessible as it is now. So I really needed to get my hands dirty with film. And so I went to New York for 3 months and did like these two post-production courses. And I was actually working on 16mm. And so that was really interesting. I think I was like the tail end of that, because digital was coming in right then. So it's interesting to still be able to play with film. And then I knocked around New York for a little while. And after that, I moved to LA and I got invited to the American Film Institute, and I did my master's over there in directing. And then after that, I just started writing and doing shorts and, you know, moving forward. Then I met Bo.
Yeah, well, that was my next question. How did you, I mean, what sort of CD circles do you have to hang in to bump into a guy like Bo Ransdell?
You've got to go on the dark web and really get into the, into the cracks and crevices.
Yeah.
You know, at the time I met Bo, I met him vis-a-vis his script for this film, which was posted on one of the websites that, you know, independent writers use to try and get other filmmakers, you know, directors and producers to find their work. And so I came across the script. I loved it. And I reached out to Bo to option it. And we started talking. And, you know, because he's in Tennessee and I'm in LA. So we definitely would never have just bumped into each other otherwise. But it was the material that brought us together. And after I optioned it off him, we started working on it, you know, a lot. And did multiple drafts, and then we were able to find a producer and take it to the next level.
And in terms of, like, obviously you're saying that you came across the actual piece of writing, and that's what kind of sparked your interest in it. Have you always been a fan of horror movies, or is it something that you've come to later on in life? What's your background in kind of horror movies?
I've always been a huge fan of horror. I grew up loving all the classic horror films, and they were the ones that had the biggest impact on me. I think, you know, when I went to film school and when especially AFI, it kind of, you know, was hammering a lot more drama into me and, you know, made me feel like the horror maybe wasn't, you know, what I should be going for. Like, I was sort of moving towards more highbrow kind of stuff just because I was in that milieu. But then when I got out, I just found that, you know, you got to be true to yourself. And I kept coming back to horror and fantasy and sci-fi, which is where I live. And it's funny because actually when I came across Bo's script, you know, there's different genres on those websites of material that you could look at. And I kind of looked at everything aside from horror first because I just was like, damn, I always go to horror. You know, I always end up in horror. So I was just like, maybe there's a good crime story. Or, but no, of course, the only script I found that I loved out of like hundreds was the one that Bo wrote and was, of course, this amazing homage to the films that I grew up loving. So that's it. You just got to, you know, be true to yourself and go with the flow.
Yeah.
I think the universe wanted me to express my love of horror and not, you know, hide it.
Yeah, never hide it. Never hide it.
Yeah.
So, Bo, obviously, we have many hours behind us chatting about horror and stuff like that, but the one we've spoken about your involvement in the project as well, but there are certain questions I've never had a chance to ask you through laziness and the hope that I might be able to do this interview somewhere down the line. So I think the question I'd ask you is, knowing that you have not exactly the greatest love for slasher movies, how did you go about writing the script to a slasher movie?
I was really drunk one night. And slasher movies called. I was in a weakened state. No, it really came out of the fact that there are so many slasher movies that I always felt like didn't deliver. Or they just didn't have a sense of what they were. You know, sometimes they get a little highfalutin, and I think we call those movies giallo.
You shush your mouth.
I know. But there were slasher movies I dearly loved, and like there were movies. The one I always go back to is a movie like Hell Night, which is a really underseen slasher film, but it was one that I always dug because it had a sense of style and a sense of knowing its purpose. And so I, you know, at the time I felt like I want to do a slasher movie that I would enjoy. And it was sort of a reaction to seeing a lot of slashers that I didn't, you know? And I would like to say I have a refined palate when it comes to slasher movies, but the reality is that it's not about my taste so much as it is, I think a lot of slasher movies were quick knockoffs and they didn't pay attention to character and things like that. And that's what I wanted to do at the end of the day was I wanted to do that classical style slasher of, you know, here are kids, let's get to know them a little bit and then let's just murder them one by one.
Yeah.
And also get into sort of the underlying philosophy of that in a way. So yeah, it was a response to a lot of movies that I have told you on other occasions that really pissed me off.
And, Ian, when you read that script, when you're reading something like that, are you already imagining from a directing point of view, kind of locations, camera, you know, angles, camera movement, casting? I mean, how early from reading that script does your mind kick into the mode of a director?
It kicks in pretty fast, I'd say, like immediately as I start reading. You know, I just have that, you know, the way my mind works, I just kind of, I'm able to start seeing it if it's well written, and if it's crap, it's crap, and we have to move on. But with this, you know, I can visualize, you know, that's one of the things that I do. So that happens pretty early on. If the writing is good and I get into the story, then I'm already sort of running it in my head as I'm watching it. But I mean, as I'm reading it, you see it. But the other thing is, I did go into it looking for a movie that I could make for roughly around $1 million, which is what I thought I could raise through my relationships, and I thought was reasonable. So I was specifically looking for stuff like that. So that was definitely in my mind. Like, is this something I could do in a contained location? And if it hadn't been, then I would have just, you know, I would have loved it, but I wouldn't have been able to get involved probably at that point. But this, you know, it was written for a single location. There's only like, you know, three or four major locations in the movie, you know, one prime one. So it was perfect. And yeah, and then I imagined that we would do most of the practical, you know, most of the effects practically and in camera. And so, I mean, there's a part of me that's thinking like that, but most of me is getting swept up in the movie and just seeing it in my head as I'm reading it, if it's well written.
Casting's next, I suppose. How do you go about that?
Yeah, that doesn't come in until way later for me. It's not like I'm reading the movie and I'm imagining different actors in those roles. I never really do that, actually, for some reason. I just read it and I see those characters that are written on the page, and it's not until later when I look at my options with my casting director that I really start to think about, you know, who these characters are, who can play them. So, yeah. And, I, you know, with that, it's like we have a casting director that we bring on, Liz Lang, who's awesome. And, you know, she's really talented at finding great teenagers, you know, kids who can play, who are great actors. It's tough. Because, you know, they don't have a lot of experience, and they're like diamonds in the rough, but she's really good at finding them, so.
I think the thing that, like, from watching the movie, one of the things that kind of stood out to me, and I think Bo kind of touched on it, about this idea of actually developing the characters, which you would think it would just be a fundamental rule of making movies or writing scripts, but for whatever reason, that slasher subgenre really goes out its way to kind of create this kind of two-dimensional image of what a teenager's like. And one of the things I quite liked about the movie was the fact that, like, from the beginning, there are certain characters you instantly like, and there's others not so much. I mean, Bo, when you come to write characters, is it like you were saying, you just take these ideas of templates of slasher movies you've seen before and said, wouldn't it be so much better if this character was more like this? Or, you know, how do you approach that angle of actually creating, like, because like myself, your teenage days are a bit behind you now. How do you go about doing that?
I don't know what you're talking about. I am eternally 18, Duncan. I think you're right. I think basically it comes down to taking the slasher tropes, because, you know, a part of the movie is about the slasher tropes and celebrating those rather than kind of skewering them. Because, basically a slasher movie is a big engine, and you have to have the right pieces to make that engine run. Otherwise, it gets all gummed up, and I'm not sure how long I can extend this metaphor. But with the
you're in the quicksand.
Yeah, I know. I was in the deep rough on that one. I still wanted to have those characters, like, you know, you want the kind of teenage bully, and you want the over pampered and spoiled girl, and you want your final girl, you know, like your kind of test true heart character. And and so having those characters, and then just trying to find little moments. And this happened not just in the original script. The original script was far less deep, you know, if I could apply that term to this movie. But, you know, like as Ian and I were talking about these characters, and we both had the same sense of it, of like we want to make these characters feel a little more real. And the way to do that is, like, let's take the stereotype and then you pepper in some moments in the film that give them a little bit more dimension. And, you know, it was something that we were really conscious of. You know, I mean, there are plenty of reviews online and stuff that can argue the success or failure of that. But it was definitely a motivation from the inception, that was part of the writing of it. But it really came with the rewrites, and once the casting happened, and you know, Ian saw kind of the kids he was working with, I think a lot of it gelled from there too. Like there are backstories to these characters that never end up on the screen. Mm-hmm. The most interesting of which I still think is Heather and Johnny. That's one I almost want to do the prequel movie that is just Heather and Johnny up until the events of the film. But yeah, you know, and I we were really lucky. I don't want to speak for Ian completely here, but I think with the casting of the kids we got, you know, there are some performances in there and some line deliveries that I dearly love. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think,
yeah,
I think for all, I was surprised at how good they were, you know, and I don't mean to minimize their efforts or anything, but I don't, you know, when you're dealing with a teenage cast or a cast of young actors, then you just kind of expect that there's going to be somebody in the mix that's not going to be pulling their weight. And, and you know, I feel like all the kids in Lost After Dark acquit themselves, not just well, but very well. And make those little moments work, make it come alive.
I definitely want to say, I think that the casting is key, you know, like the writing was, it was important to give them what to say on the page and find those moments for them like we did. But then, you know, you really only do have so much time to bring them alive before you start killing them. And there's like eight of them. So it was important to find actors that were likable from the get-go and that really embodied the spirit of those characters. And we really nailed that on the casting. I got to say, we got like very lucky that the actors, I got all my first choices. And the first time that I got them all together down on set, and we went for a dinner, I was actually walking behind them with my assistant going over something, and they were all walking in front of me like a little posse, and we were heading to the restaurant. And when I looked up at them, I just realized I know exactly each of these characters from behind just by the way they're walking and what they're wearing. And they weren't in wardrobe. They were in their own wardrobe, but their own wardrobe mirrored the characters the way they were written anyways. You know what I'm saying? Like Johnny was more styled, and Eve, who plays Marilyn, was dressed like a rocker chick. And Kendra, who's the girl next door, was like, you know, had her little cardigan on. You know what I'm saying? Like it was uncanny. So that helped a lot. And also they were so gung-ho. You know, we didn't have a lot of time to rehearse at all, and we didn't even have time for a table read by the time I got them all down there and we were getting ready to shoot. And after that dinner, you know, I had mentioned that it's too bad we didn't have the chance for a table read, and they were like, fuck it, let's just do it right now. So they all came over at midnight after the dinner, and we read the script together and worked on it until the morning. So they were really committed, and they really got along well with each other as well. You know, there's a story behind that, but they were actually friends. A lot of them kind of knew each other beforehand as actors and as, you know, people, and so that made it easier as well to create that dynamic that they actually, you know, had history together on screen.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, a lot of viewers of movies have this kind of preconceived conception that you get a script, you get a director, you get some cast, you find a location, you go out and shoot. The technicalities of the movie, you know, that doesn't come into play. I mean, how much time are we talking from the point of you finding Bo's script to working with him to raising the funds to finding the cast to actually the first day of shoot? Are we talking months, years, you know, what ballpark figure?
I can give you not a ballpark figure. I can give you an exact figure. It was 2010 when I read the script.
And, Jesus, right.
And fell in love with it. And that's when we started working on it together. And in 2012 was when we got it going with Gold Rush, our producer. And we got the you know, Gold Rush brought in the Northern Ontario Heritage Fund, which is this, you know, commission up north of Toronto, which for Northern Ontario, which brings work, you know, brings films there and gives grants to create jobs. So we got a third of our budget from those guys, and we got a third of our budget from the Canadian tax credit. So we had to go about finding the other third of our budget, which was around $400,000 or $500,000 Canadian. Sorry, U.S. So anyways, we actually did a pretty good job of that. We put all the money together. We had a successful raise, and we got everything going. And the film was supposed to shoot in 2013, right, Bo? At the in November.
I had tickets to go to the set. Like, had to get my passport rushed and everything.
And now, at this point, Bo and I had never met each other in person. We'd been working together all this time remotely, and we were excited to meet on the set of the movie, which was about to shoot in 72 hours. And then suddenly the plug got pulled because a different producer who was involved with the project was supposed to bring something called the bridge financing, which now gets a little complicated. But even though we had all our money in place, some of that money, a bulk of that money, was coming from the Canadian tax credit and from the grant. And that money was coming later on in the process. And you need about two-thirds of your budget to start filming and pay out the crew and actually get through the shoot. So there's somebody who comes in with a bridge to bridge that gap, whatever it is. And this guy didn't deliver like he said he would. And so the producers were faced with the dilemma of, do we start shooting this movie and then halfway through stop paying people and just try and, you know, finish it off, potentially get stuck, or do we just shut it down and figure it out? And that's what happened. We got shut down, and it took 9 more months to find the rest of the financing and extricate ourselves from that other producer and get everything back together and get it back up and running. And when it did, I only had, the first time I had 5 weeks to prep the film, and then it got pulled. But the second time I only had 2 weeks to prep the film in a different location. And 4 of those days, they're very, very religious up in Sudbury. And so I lost the weekend. So we really only had 10 days to prep the film.
And God.
Luckily we had cast it. We had done all our casting the first time around, and somehow miraculously nine months later, all these kids were available to me, which was bizarre because they're always working, you know, they're talented. Yeah. And it was just crazy that we were able to lock them all in. I didn't have to go to a whole new casting. So that made it work. But yeah, I had like 10 days to prep it. And then we were supposed to shoot it over 18 days. And it took 16 days because I lost 2 days along the way because of the budget that's in the filmmaking. And then, you know, so, and then we wrapped it. And that was like, we shot it in 2014, I think, or 13, right, Bo?
It shot in 2014. It was wrapped in the fall, and then post-production was supposed to be done. But the weird thing about, like, the shutdown, and this is sort of the story of the little movie that could, because a movie being shut down prior to production, for especially for the reasons that Lost After Dark was, the fact that it exists at
all—that's common, by the way.
Yeah, it's common for the shutdowns.
Yeah, usually it kills
happen.
It, doesn't it?
Yeah,
usually it kills the project altogether.
Everybody told, when I came back to LA, I was the last person there on set. By the way, in the winter, it was snowing on my head, and it was a nightmare out there. And I was just praying to God it would come back somehow. And I wanted to be like the captain who went down with his ship. And so I was the last guy out there in the snow. And then when I came back to LA, everybody told me that film was dead. When the film shuts down beforehand, and happens often. You know, I met an agent, by the way, who's at one of the big agencies around this time we were talking, and he told me he covers indie films and that he covers 200 films a year that are supposed to go and that have financing. And he said maybe 20 of them get off the ground. You know, these are films that are casting. These are films that are looking to attach talent or that are scouting locations. And those were his numbers. So it's pretty common, but yeah, everybody thought we were dead. But we fought like hell, and we resurrected this bitch. So it was awesome. We were like the Phoenix. It really came down to the wire, though. It really did. It came down to, like, a day where the producer was just like, it's, you know, we're going to have to pull the plug at noon. I'm going to have to send out a letter. And I was like, just give me till the end of the day. And then we found the money to complete the film and go forward. So it was like a minor miracle. So it's just, it's really amazing that it's being released right now in the UK, and it came out now, it came out in Canada and the US and Germany and Australia. So it's exciting that it's like this thing that almost didn't happen that we fought for at least 5 years. It's finally there at fruition. You know, you guys can all take a bite.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing is as well, good distributors. In the UK, it's being put out by Metrodome, and Metrodome are a substantial company for distribution of movies. And was it, I'm gonna get this wrong, is Anchor Bay in the States, Bo?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, Anchor Bay took care of is distributing in the States and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And it's went really well here. We had a great opening, and the film sold out of a lot of the stores that it was in, like the Walmarts and the Targets and Best Buys. It's also on iTunes and Vudu and Amazon, and it's everywhere. So they did a really good job of getting it out there. We're really, really happy with what happened out here in North America.
You can't.
Let's hope the UK is strong. Yes. the little film that could, and you know, for the most part, the horror community's really embraced it and had a lot of fun with it, and really gotten behind the film. So that, you know, we've had a lot of fun with that with our fans.
Oh, it's a fun fucking movie. It really is. Mm. Like Bo beforehand was like when he was speaking of it, he obviously didn't want to spoil it for me, but he got a bit giddy like a schoolgirl, and at certain points mentioned bits I should look out for. there's some this movie in certain parts. I mean, it's a fun watch, but certain parts gets quite dark and quite mean, which a lot of slasher movies will shy away from now. I don't know why. That genre used to be one that was fairly, you know, it came at you with teeth, and for some reason it kind of shied away, especially in the more recent ones. But this one definitely harks back to that idea of when you're watching it, you really don't know which character's safe. And I quite like that about a movie. I think it adds to the danger level, and I think that the movie definitely captures that. And aesthetically, I mean, it does feel very vintage. It feels of the era as well. You have one particular star in this movie who played a Terminator. And I mean,
yes,
that in itself is pretty fucking huge. What was it like working with a Terminator on set?
Oh man, the T-1000, Robert Patrick. He's awesome, as would be expected, but he's a perfect gentleman. He's really, really fun guy. He's got a great sense of humor. He's always smoking his cigar, so, you know, he'll be waiting for his shot. He's smoking his cigar, he'll put it down, go do his take, come back, put it back, you know, keep smoking. He's just fucking cool. He's Robert Patrick. But he's great. He was really cool with the young cast. There was one time when after I wrapped him and David Lipper, they went to one of the only bars that were open in this small town. It was like a little bar restaurant. There was like 12 people in it or something. And David says that when they walked in, like, they all just looked at them, and one guy said, "You look like the Terminator." And he said, "I am the goddamn Terminator." And then he bought them all drinks. And so he's just a really, you know, generous guy. And he was cool. You know, the first night he came in, you know, we had him picked up, and this is a funny story, but the Canadian immigration, there was a woman who was working when he came through, and I guess she was a big fan of his, and she slipped him her number. So, you know, he's happily married, but I'm sure that made him feel like a total stud. So right coming off the plane, he was in a good mood. And then when he got to the hotel, it was really late, but there had been a flight delay and everything. It was like probably around close to midnight, and I was waiting for him out there, and there were these three guys that had just gotten out of this van from the airport also, and they saw him, and they just freaked out. These guys just were like, "Holy fuck, it's the Terminator." And so they looked at their cameras, and he was really kind, and he took a bunch of pictures with them. So even before he got to registration at the hotel desk, I think he was like, you know, having a good can of a run and feeling pretty good. And then, you know, he invited me up to his, you know, our rooms were next to each other, and he invited me over to smoke a cigar and talk about the character. And so we spent about an hour doing that, and he threw out a bunch of ideas, and we talked about some of the scenes, and then he was just a dream to work with. He was just always on his mark. You know, he handles a flashlight like a motherfucker. I mean, he was, you know, he had a bunch of years on X-Files, so he really knows how to handle that flashlight. You know, like with the kids, you have to explain to them how to shine the light into the lens so you get that flare. Mm-hmm. But Robert's like, you know, spinning the flashlight like it's a gun and doing tricks. And like, it's just, you know, mess with Robert and his flashlight or his cigar. So, yeah, he was great.
And he also, they're like my favorite lines in the movie now are lines that he ad-libbed.
Yeah, he did a lot. We really gave him free rein to just go with it. Although I will tell you another funny story. Right in the first time I was shooting with him, we were doing like an exterior scene outside the front of the school, and he's just being introduced. He comes out and he throws one of the kids in, and sort of introducing him as a disciplinarian. And there were no lines written for him there, but like 5 minutes before we were shooting, he just kind of like leaned over and whispered in my ear, and he's like, "You know, you're paying me." And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, if you want to give me some lines, I'm here. And I'm like, shit, he's right. I should give him some lines. And so then I called up Bo, and we came up with something on the spot. And then I ran over and I slipped it to him just as he was walking up the steps to the school, because they were calling me to get to the monitor. I mean, you have to move pretty fast on these indie films. Mm-hmm. And then I went and I kind of stalled for a second, and then I called action. And then he came out the door and he just nailed it, that whole speech. He just nailed it in like 2 minutes. You know, he had about a second to read it. So he's a dream. And then, you know, when he's having some of his bigger moments, we really let him go off toward the end. And it was just awesome what was coming out of his mouth. You know. But he also really got the tone of the film. That's the thing about Robert. You know, he really got it. He really understood, you know, what we were going for. And so it was just, it was easy. It was easy working with him, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Another common misconception. I'm just shattering the illusion here. Another common misconception is that you, Bo, wrote a movie, and you, Ian, helped, you know, rewrite that movie and direct that movie, and that movie is now out and people can buy it. So you two are now millionaires, obviously.
Sure.
You know, burning 50s to light your cigars. Because that's what happens, right?
Oh my gosh. I think I got paid like, I don't even think I got paid $1 an hour. I was going to say $1 an hour. I don't even think I made $1 an hour. All said and done, all the time that we put into it and all the love and all the effort, you know, and just the hours, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah. is it a case of essentially that as soon as that project's done, you already kind of have to hustle to get the next project going? Or is there downtime at all? Or is it... From your point of view as a director, that project is now done, it's finished, but, you know, I now need to start looking at what I can do next.
Well, you know, it was pretty all consuming. Up until the point where I finished it and, you know, it was done, and I thought, okay, it's done. Now I can move on to the next thing. But then I quickly realized that wasn't the case, because there's a whole other process of, you know, helping the film find a distributor and getting it to the festivals and getting people to see it and just getting eyeballs on it. I mean, you can make the greatest film in the world, but if nobody sees it, like, you know, nobody sees it. So there's a whole other job that you don't realize, this whole other thing that happens after the movie's finished, where it's like, well, now we have to figure out how to get people to see the movie. And that took another year. You know, that was a year of going to festivals and finding the right people to blog about it, who, you know, take a look at the film and put it out there. And you know, eventually Anchor Bay got on board, and then, you know, things picked up steam. They brought in a PR, you know, a PR company to handle it, and they took it to the next level. But even then, we had interviews we had to do and things to do to get ready for the film, and there was, like, you know, advanced screenings and Q&As, and so it was still pretty all-consuming. I didn't really have time to think about it too much. Just before I went into the project, Bo and I had discussed doing a reboot of Waxwork. And yeah. So we had kind of broken the story a little bit on that and gotten the blessing from Anthony Hickox, who's a good friend of mine who did the original. And then I went into production. Then we finally got the money on our film, and we suddenly jumped into production. And so Bo went and wrote a draft of that with another friend of his, which is a great draft. And then he's done some work since. So that's something that I'm trying to set up right now. But it was only in the last maybe 6 months that I've been trying to figure out what's my next project. Mm-hmm. And it's been tough. That's been a really, you know, it's tough to find, you know, me and Bo have stuff that we're writing. A lot of it right now is a little bit too expensive to be made. So, you know, we're working on something a little bit smaller while we're still trying to get the bigger things off the ground with some of these producers that we have attached to them. But, you know, look, you know, it's a tough time for film right now, you know, in general. But I definitely don't have my next job going yet, and that's kind of, you know, something that I'm hungry to make happen in terms of the directing effort. But you know, we've got a bunch of things in development that we're working on, and hopefully one of those will pop soon. So, but it's definitely not all roses. It's not like you finish your film and then get swept up and get showered with more films and TV shows and lots of money.
Yeah.
It's a battle. You know, you just got to stay in it. Keep fighting.
And you know, we were fairly well received, you know, as a horror film. So, you know, that doesn't translate into anything, but there are some nice reviews out there. But yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, you're starting back from zero of, okay, well, now let's find the project, and now let's see if we can get investors into it. You know, like, your track record is only so important because, like Ian said, it's just right now film is going through this very weird transitional period, and it's tough. You know, like, Ian has it a whole lot worse than I do because he's the guy out there that does most of the hustling, rightfully so, because I'm real garbage at it. And so, like, it is to his credit that, you know, the movie got made, that the movie got out the way it did. Like, you know, I will take credit for some of that, but it would be wrong. You know, I mean, he's really the guy that made all that happen. And I, you know, I just get to sit back and, you know, cheerlead for the most part.
But I will say it's been, it is different now. Definitely now that we've done a film, now that I have a film that I've directed that, you know, we can, you know, the next time we go to distributors or producers or financiers and we're looking to raise money, we at least have a film, and it's a film that was well received, that people really like, that we can give to them to watch. And that is a huge hurdle that we kind of crossed. You know, that's like, mm-hmm. a big barrier. There's a big difference between never having made a feature and having made a feature.
I
can tell you, when you meet somebody who's never made a feature and you tell them that you made a feature, they go, oh, that's amazing. That's congratulations. But when you meet somebody who's made a feature and you tell them, I just made a feature, they give you a big hug and they go, wow, man, you know, wow. You know, because they know the hell you
They've
went
been through the same
to make
struggle,
that happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so we've crossed that hurdle at least, you know.
How much does the fact that you've made a horror movie impact what potential projects come up next? Because horror is one of these genres that tends to always make its money back, if not more. It's almost a safe bet. It's a sure thing, assuming you're not spending like huge amounts of money on it. They tend to be a safe bet for people investing money in movies. They tend to be a great way to break actors, directors, you know, into the forefront of kind of starting their movie career. But how much of that
becomes a stigma for the next project? Is that a case of, well, you've done a feature movie, that's great, let's discuss where we can go with the next movie? Or is it, oh, well, you've made a horror movie, here's a horror script? You know, does that is it a case that you get you will now more likely be pushed another horror project, or likely be able to get the funding for another horror project than, say, for example, a drama or a thriller or?
Well, no, I think a thriller is like fine. Like, you know, if you go, that's still there. But if we're talking like a comedy, or a musical or something, then yeah, I think to some degree. There's a lot of factors here. That's like a bit of a complicated question because on one hand, the script is the script. Like, you know, the script is king. And if it's great material, and especially if you can attach some talent to it, then I think I probably could get a musical or a comedy going if it came down to it. But ultimately, you know, you want them to think of you to be able to know what you do. Like if you do a musical and a comedy and a horror, then it's hard for them to remember you. Do you know what I'm saying? In terms of the next job, they're like, they get a scary film and they're like, let's get this guy who does scary. They won't necessarily think of you. So I think from getting more work and first of all, I love genre film and I love, you know, horror, sci-fi and fantasy. And I think as long as we stay in that wheelhouse, I can do, you know, it'll be easier to get the next project going for sure compared to something that was out of that genre. But I don't think I have to stay strict in, you know, horror is a very wide ranging genre. So, you know, the next film is definitely not going to necessarily be a slasher unless it's the sequel to this, which, you know, there's already a draft for, so that's very exciting. But, yeah, I mean, right now I'm working on a more elevated horror thing, though, that's more of a character-driven, you know, psychological horror thriller. And I think that's, you know, it will be easier to find financing and to get people to believe that you can make a great movie in that genre, given that we've just worked in that genre and done it. So we are going to sort of stick in that zone for sure. And happily so.
And the cranky old man answer to that is also like... people investing money in what you're doing, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ian, or if I step out of line, but they want to feel like if they're giving you money, it's because of a thing that is a relatively sure bet. So if you've directed a horror movie, then there's a more of a comfort level with giving you a project that is, you know, a thriller, horror, sci-fi, et cetera, as opposed to that comedy or musical. And, you know, like the investors are not there most of the time to make a movie. The investors are there to make money.
Yeah.
Right. And that guy who's giving you the job is basically looking for excuses to not get fired. And so if the film does great, he's great. But if it does poorly, he can say, well, look, he did this other great horror film and there was no reason to think he wouldn't do it again with this. But if he points and says, well, he did that wonderful musical, you know, his head rolls.
He did Springtime for Hitler, and then
and then we gave him, you know, $2 million for this. So
there is something to be said for directors that come out of the genre, like you say. I mean, some of the biggest, in fact, one of the biggest movies of recent times, Guardians of the Galaxy, was helmed by someone who graduated from the School of Trauma Movies, so, you know, someone that was used to working on shoestring budgets and like a lot of nonsense on set would go on to helm a hugely successful moving forward franchise of you know, intellectual property of a massive studio. So there is something about that kind of that understanding of being able to work with budget to budget and deliver something which makes money back and more within this genre, which maybe extends above all others. You tend to find that a lot of the names that go on and do huge things are the ones that come from this neck of the woods, which I think is quite cool. It's a testament to hard work and hard craft. So obviously you touched on, this is my last question, but you did touch on, and I would be remiss if I didn't touch on this, the fact that There was a rumor flying around. You guys were talking to people when you were out partying in LA, and the mention of a Waxwork sequel, or sorry, not sequel, remake. Or reimagining.
Yeah. Another remake, Ian. Get excited about it.
Yeah.
it's now, a reboot. A reboot. So
that's Hollywood speak.
So. Oh, my favourite one recently was when they were talking about essentially a reboot of Halloween, and they called it a recalibration. And I was like, I don't even know what that means.
Would be a recalibrated reimagining of Waxwork.
I've known Bo for a couple of years now, and I know that I obviously didn't know the extent of the project. I know it was something he had been working on for a while. Obviously, getting your own project off the ground from scratch in terms of this is an original script, it's an original project, original story, moving it forward, the battle to get that out is quite considerable, because you're asking people to gamble money on something they're unsure of, except that it's a genre. When it comes to something like a remake or a reboot, is it any easier? Because you're dealing with property that, on some level, people should know, so the marketing should be easier, you would think, because they're not having to work as hard to sell something into the imagination that people already know. How different is that, trying to get that? Is it the same battle, or is it a completely different battle that requires different weapons?
Well, it's not like Waxwork was the biggest movie. It's not like Poltergeist, let's say, which, you know, everybody knows. So yeah. It depends who you're talking to. A lot of people have, you know, fond memories of it and really love it. And so it makes it easy when you're in the discussion phase. But the truth is, you know, Lionsgate owns the rights. So in order for us to remake that movie, we have to negotiate with Lionsgate and get those rights. And that's what makes it harder than an original script sometimes. I mean, from a marketing standpoint, it's easier because once you get to that marketing phase, you are, you know, you're able to draw on the older fan base. And, you know, recently Waxwork had a screening out here where Tony went there and Deborah Foreman was there, and they did a Q&A, and it was at Quentin Tarantino's Cine Family Theater, and the place was jammed. I mean, yeah. It was jammed. So, you know, there's a lot of fans out there, and it will make it easier in the marketing phase. But right now, while we're trying to set the film up, it's a little tougher because we have to negotiate the rights with Lionsgate and convince them that we're the right guys for the job. And that involves some hoops that we have to jump through. So that's where that project is right now. It's like, we'd be ready to make it, but we need to figure out the right situation first. We have a good producer attached right now, though, who's working with us on that. So we'll see. We're close.
Yeah, fantastic.
But, you know, we're close doesn't mean anything. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right. Everything's close. Yeah.
Yeah, we're close. I mean, we have, you know, we're working on it, but who knows?
It's one of those movies that I do have fond memories of when I was a kid. It's one of those ones I remember from the old VHS days. So, it would be very cool to see a kind of reimagined modern version of that movie, so fingers crossed that happens. And obviously the success of Lost After Dark, as it works its way through different territories, will only bolster the chances of that happening. Like I said at the start of this interview, Lost After Dark finally makes its way to the UK on the 29th of February. It's being distributed by Metrodome. It can be purchased anywhere that DVDs can be bought, which is fantastic, and on Amazon, who have a special price on it just now, so you can pick yourself up a copy of that DVD for the measly sum of $7.99, which is nothing. That's like two pints over here. That's two beers. So just go without.
That's how we pitched it. This is a two-beer movie.
Just go without those two beers and pick yourself up a coffee copy, because you are supporting not only the kind of independent horror cinema makers out there and movie makers, but it's supporting guys that are obviously very passionate about it. So yeah, that is coming out on the 29th of February. Thank you very much to my guests at this time, Mr. Bo Ransdell and Ian Kesner. Can I, before you go though, get you to plug some of your social media so people can follow you to keep up to date with your projects. Bo, we'll start with you. Where can people check you out on Twitter, Facebook, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much all my stuff is tied up in the Legion podcast stuff. That's the easiest way to find me. That's where I'm most active. So that's at Legion Podcasts on Twitter and Facebook.com/Legion Podcasts. And if you want to follow my personal Twitter feed, which occasionally I will retweet something that Barry Crimmins says, is at Bo in Tennessee TN.
And you also have some works for purchase on Amazon.
Yeah. There, if you search my name on Amazon, you will find a couple of books there to read about supernatural detectives and murder. Because that's the kind of thing I think about when the lights go out.
And Ian, do you have a Facebook, a Twitter that people can check out, website, anything like that?
Yeah, if they want to follow Lost After Dark, we're on Instagram, just at Lost After Dark. And, you know, same with Twitter, just Lost After Dark, or at Twitter, at Lost After Dark. And then Facebook as well. We have a Facebook page. So I'm always posting stuff. I respond to people within 24 hours. You know, that's where you can get in touch with me. Or you can go to our Dark Spark website, which is darkspark.com. And you can leave me and Bill a message. And we'll get back to you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. I know both of you are very busy gentlemen, so thank you for sparing some time for this interview. I'm going to take a very short break just now. When I come back, I'm closing out my show right after this.
You're listening to the podcast Under the Stairs.
And you've been listening to this very special bonus episode of the podcast Under the Stairs. I was joined by Bo Ransdell and Ian Kesner, and we discussed their movie Lost After Dark. Like I said in that interview, Lost After Dark is on sale in the UK as of today, the day that this show has been released, 29th February 2016. You can buy it on DVD, you can check it out on iTunes, you can check it out in other mediums, it's on VOD, and it'd be cool to see you guys go out and support this movie. Bo is a great guy. He has supported so many podcast projects and so many shows, gives up his time tirelessly to put out content through Legion Podcasts. He's a very good friend of mine, and the fact that one of our own has the opportunity to put a movie out there, everyone should be behind it and supporting it. It helps that the movie's actually quite a bit fun. It has a quite mean streak in it, like I talked about in the interview, and I dig that. And you never know, if enough of us support it, they may get their sequel out, or they may get their Waxwork remake that they're trying to get off the ground. If there's enough buzz about it, enough people wanting it, I'm sure that eventually people will take notice in higher places and make sure that shit happens. So thanks very much to my guests for giving up a bit of time. Like I said at the top of this episode, I will be joined by the Baz next week. That episode will go out as scheduled on the Monday. I will not be in the UK. I will be in Vegas when that show drops. God knows what I will be doing in Vegas. You know what they say, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. So that show will go out anyway. I'll have things put in place that it will drop. And then I will return the following week. And that week's going to be some sort of episode of some description. I have no idea what I'm going to do. I will try and arrange some guests and get something recorded, but it really won't be until the following week that business picks back up to the standard format of the podcast Under the Stairs with movie reviews. There may be some short removes or reviews of things. I am going to see 10 Cloverfield Lane when I'm in the States, so that may be worth talking about. And when I come back, I'll also be looking at The Witch. So I might talk about that. Who knows? You can never tell, and it's never a good idea to plan too far ahead just in case things fall apart. So yeah, those shows will be coming. Just a quick reminder, episode number 3 of season one of Chronicle Podcast, my side podcast, will be out today as well. So you can check that out on Legion Podcast Network, or you can search for it through iTunes for Legion, or it has its own feed now on iTunes. So you just type in Chronicle Podcast and it should pop up. Subscribe to that show if you like it. I hope you like it, and leave us some feedback over there. It's always good to get feedback on iTunes. It's the best way to support any show, and it's free to do. I put out a call for some new feedback reviews on iTunes just a couple of days ago, and you guys really rallied behind it, and some of the reviews have been funny as fuck to read and pretty awesome. Thank you very much for giving up a bit of time to support this show. Whew, so I have prattled on quite a bit. You've heard me talk a lot. You've heard us talk a lot about Lost After Dark. Hopefully you guys will go and check out that movie. They are selling it on Amazon for the measly sum of $7.99, which is cheap. So go forth, consume, and support that movie. There is a multitude of ways to check out this show, though. You can check us out on iTunes, and like I mentioned, if you haven't left us a review, please do. You can check us out on Stitcher, on SoundCloud. Go over and check out our website, teapotscast.com. And join our Facebook group, some new members over there, and that's been great to see, instantly interacting with folk like the Baz. I don't know why you would want to just go down that road straight away, but God bless you all. That's facebook.com/groups/teapotscast, and our Instagram competition officially closed today. So we will be announcing the winner very soon. What movie will be covered by myself and the Baz down the line, and who won that horror block full of goodies. That'll be announced on the page, so keep your eyes peeled for that. Our Instagram, if you want to keep tweeting us pictures and suggestions of movies to cover, or what you're watching, if you're watching a movie and want to let us know, then you can tag us by going to Instagram, posting a photo, and tag us at TeapotsCast. Baz is in charge of the Twitter. If you want to contact us through Twitter, it's at TeapotsCast on there as well. Nice and easy. All TeapotsCast, all the time. Right, I'm going to get out of here before I bore you all to tears. Thank you once again for supporting the show. This show would not be possible without yourselves, and it is the reason that I do it. The day that no one wants to listen to it, it's the day that I stop. So please take care of yourselves out there. I will be thinking of you all as I travel the globe to parts unknown, namely Washington DC and Las Vegas. And when I get back, I can't wait to speak to your faces. But until then, please take care of yourselves out there, wherever you are, whatever you're doing. This is Duncan McLeish, broadcasting live from under the stairs, signing off.